February 8th, 2017 started out as just another normal day for Reagan Toks. The 21-year-old psychology major left her apartment near Ohio State University around 5 p.m. to go to work at Bodega, a bar/restaurant in the Short North Arts District of Columbus. At 9:43 p.m., after working her shift and eating dinner there, Reagan left work to walk to where her car was parked. It was reported that normally, one of the bartenders would walk Reagan to her car at the end of her shift. But on this Wednesday night, she was seen on surveillance video, walking out alone. And that surveillance video was the last time she would ever be seen alive again. Today's case tells the tragic story of Reagan Toks, a 21-year-old Ohio State University student who encountered evil on the night of February 8, 2017. But what's different about this story, as opposed to others you may have heard on this podcast, is that this entire case may have possibly been prevented. And you'll see what I mean by that in just a little bit. Sometimes, as we all know, the system that is designed to protect us actually fails us. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 52. When Reagan's friends and family couldn't get a hold of her the next day, they grew concerned. They had tried texting and calling her, but had gotten no response, which was very unlike Reagan. Reagan's mom called the university and found out that she hadn't shown up to any of her classes that day. And when Reagan's sister spoke with her roommate, they learned that Reagan had never returned home from work the night before. They started calling hospitals and jails to see if something had happened and to see if she was there, but no luck. Reagan's coworkers then called the police to file a missing persons report.
Columbus Police, Tech 62.
Hi. So we had an employee leave work last night, and she has not been home. Her phone is off. Nobody can find her. So I wanted to see what I could do about filing a report or getting any kind of documentation down.
Okay, so she left work and you haven't heard from her, and like she didn't report today?
Correct. Her mom's been calling, looking for her. We can't find her car around work. I called the jail, and they said she wasn't in the Franklin County Jail, so...
Okay,
just trying to see what my next step
is
here.
We can do it. If you have her address, we can send the police to her house to do a well check on her.
Well, actually, her roommates are here. She hasn't been home at all either.
Reagan's family and friends would get their answers sooner rather than later. Because meanwhile, while Reagan's loved ones were frantically looking for her, about 12 miles away in Grove City, Ohio, Richard Bonner was pulling into the Scioto Grove Metro Park to turn his car around when he saw something that caught his eye. It was about 1 p.m. and he could see what looked like a mannequin about 15 feet from the entrance of the park. He stopped his car, got out, and went a little closer. He soon realized that it wasn't a mannequin at all. It was the nude body of a young woman, her arm across her bloodied face. He immediately called 911. Police officers and paramedics descended onto the scene. It was clear that the young woman was dead. She had been shot twice in the head, and it didn't take long to figure out that she was the one who had just been reported missing in nearby Columbus, 21-year-old Reagan Toks. Reagan Delaney Toks was born on March 13, 1995, to Lisa and Toby Toks. She was one of two children. She had a younger sister named Mackenzie. They grew up in Maumee, Ohio, and Reagan was an active member of the Maumee United Methodist Church. She went on mission trips with youth groups, and friends told reporters that she had a passion for helping others and that she was, quote, amazing, a very loving and happy person. Reagan was a psychology major at OSU and was due to graduate in May, just 3 months after she died. Her last tweet on her Twitter account, posted just 3 days before her death, read, "Today my dad emailed me diploma frames and told me to pick one out, and I'd be lying if I said I didn't tear up." But while Reagan should have been getting ready for graduation and finishing up her classes, her funeral and celebration of her life was held instead. Meanwhile, investigators were working hard to try and figure out what had happened to her and who had killed her. On February 10th, a license plate reader came across Reagan's car, a 1999 silver Acura, abandoned on a residential street, 10 miles from where her body had been found. And the car seemed to have some promising clues in it. When the responding officer opened her car door, he was overwhelmed by the smell of gas, and there was a burn mark on the driver's seat, as though someone had tried to start the car on fire. But what would end up leading them to the killer? Two cigarette butts that were found in and around the vehicle. One of them was sent to the lab for testing, and the DNA was a match to someone already in their system. 29-year-old Brian Lee Goolsbee.
My name is Jeff Pearson. I'm the chief of police with the Grove City Division of Police. And today announcing that we did make an arrest in connection with the murder of Reagan Toks. We have arrested Brian L. Goolsbee, and he's been charged with aggravated murder, aggravated kidnapping, and aggravated robbery in reference to the murder of Reagan Toks. We discovered her body on Thursday, February 9th at the Cider Grove Metropolitan Park.
At the press conference announcing the arrest, Sergeant Chris White said that Brian was a registered sex offender with no known connection to Reagan.
Our officers and detectives worked the rest of the night and through the morning locating Goolsbee. With the assistance of Columbus Police SWAT officers and patrol officers, we executed a search warrant of Goolsbee's residence at 1049 Forest Street in Columbus. We arrested Goolsbee there. It was around 4 a.m. After his arrest, detectives interviewed Goolsbee. Based upon the evidence collected at the scene and Goolsbee's statements and other forensic evidence, we are charging him with kidnapping, aggravated robbery, and the aggravated murder of Reagan Toks.
Sergeant White told reporters that this wasn't Brian's first offense.
Back in 2010, he was arrested and convicted of kidnapping and rape, and it was actually a Grove City case. Out of that case, he spent around 6 years in prison. He just got out of prison in November of 2016.
What Sergeant White didn't say at this press conference was that Brian had been out on parole and had been wearing a GPS-monitored ankle bracelet at the time of Reagan's death. In a local news article from 2010, the details of Brian's prior crime were mortifying. Quote, Grove City Police said Brian Goolsbee pulled a knife on a woman in the parking lot of an apartment complex and raped her in front of her 2-year-old son. The article then goes on to say that Brian forced the woman to go to an ATM and take money out. They said they also suspected him of robbing another woman in that same parking lot 2 weeks prior. He was charged with 10 counts, but after the prosecutor said there were issues with the case should it go forward to trial, a plea deal was struck, and Brian pleaded guilty to robbery and attempted rape. He spent 6 years in prison, and while he was serving his time, he was less than an ideal inmate, hit with 52 violations. 6 of those violations were from fighting with other inmates. 2 of them were from using expletives to female guards. 2 were from possessing illegal or misusing prescription drugs, and 2 involved stealing. Yet no additional time was added to his sentence because of those infractions. Ohio has a law about determinant sentencing, meaning the state can't keep him in custody for longer than what he was sentenced to. So when his 6 years were up, he was released and fitted with an ankle monitor. According to the criminal complaint in Reagan's case, it looks like Brian had a similar MO with Reagan as he did in his prior case. He admitted to detectives that he made her go to an ATM and forced her to withdraw money from her account. But what Brian didn't admit to was to killing her. Instead, he told police that someone else, a man named TJ, had done it. Brian's arraignment was held on April 3rd, 2017. Prosecutors announced that he was facing an 18-count indictment, including charges of aggravated robbery, kidnapping, rape, tampering with evidence, and aggravated murder with death penalty specifications. Brian pleaded not guilty to all counts. And then prosecutor Ron O'Brien made another shocking announcement about the case. They believed that Brian had not only been responsible for Reagan's murder, but that he had also been involved in a string of violent robberies that had taken place in the area over the last 2 months. Prior to Reagan's disappearance and murder, police had been investigating the robberies in the German Village area, where women had reported being punched and robbed, some even pistol whipped and held up at knife point. Aggravated robbery charges were added to Brian's case. And if that wasn't enough, reports soon surfaced that the parole authority knew that Brian had openly violated his parole on 3 separate occasions for not being where he was supposed to be. But before he was to attend a hearing on it, he had been arrested for Reagan's murder. The significance of what this all meant wasn't lost on Reagan's family. Brian had been released from prison just 3 months prior, in November 2016, and already he was being tied to some pretty vicious crimes, including the murder of their daughter. Upon Brian's release, he had been entered into a temporary housing program called the Exit Program. But while in the program, Brian was free to come and go as he pleased. He just had to be there between the hours of 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. But the Exit Program wasn't very strict in their rules. Brian had a pass to be out during those hours by simply stating that he was working during that time, which is what it appeared he did. Investigators said they were able to use the ankle monitor to tie Brian to his crimes. But what many people in the community were asking was, what good was the ankle monitor if it wasn't able to prevent these crimes from happening? Even before Brian went to trial, Reagan's family began working with Ohio legislators on the Reagan-Tokes Act as a way to reform what they called 4 shortfalls in the criminal justice system. 1, they wanted to give judges more discretion at sentencing for first and second degree felonies and third degree violent felonies. 2, they wanted to require the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction, the DRC, to create and recommend a reentry program for violent and dangerous felons not accepted into other reentry programs. 3, they wanted to require the DRC to establish parole officer guidelines, which would include a minimum number of hours that an officer must dedicate to a parolee, which would ensure proper oversight for all parolees. And lastly, they wanted to create a new policy for offender GPS monitoring in order to better identify suspicious activity based on the offender's location. In November 2017, Reagan's mom spoke before 2 separate House and Senate committees. It was the first time she was speaking publicly since her daughter's death.
And this pain is something I can't even put into words. No person should ever have to experience what she did. And no parent or family should ever have to live with it for the remainder of their lives. Reagan did, and we are, and it is so wrong. It is especially wrong due to the flaws and failures with the current laws and practices of the state of Ohio. This is where responsibility lies for what happened to her, along with the evil that inflicted his presence and violence upon her. Her alleged attacker has a very lengthy criminal history and a violent prison record. This history should matter, and it should come with additional consequences, not rights and freedoms with no boundaries. The way the current laws exist, his violent behavior while incarcerated had no consequences, nor did his repeated violation of parole. He should have never been out on the streets, and he especially should not have been out there unmonitored, but he was. He was, and because there were no consequences and he knew it, he continued to wreak havoc on the streets and assault the innocent until he allegedly committed the most violent assault yet, the one in which our daughter would suffer through hours of unimaginable terror and ultimately lose her life. She was left in a field naked. Naked and shot twice in the head on a bitterly cold night. and she laid there for 12 hours before somebody found her frozen, lifeless body. Do you know what it is like to sit here knowing this to be factual and to have lost what we had in the manner in which we did? I'm sure none of you do, but try to imagine being in our shoes for just a second. I guarantee you it is shoes that you don't ever want to get near, let alone walk a mile in. These are the shoes we now walk in, however. It is our present and our future, and it is a living hell.
Brian's trial for Reagan's murder started on March 5th, 2018, at the Franklin County Courthouse. Franklin County Prosecutor Ron O'Brien detailed the finding of Reagan's body and the investigation that followed. He told the court that Reagan didn't have any personal items found on her. She was completely nude, and through a small circular tattoo she had on her ribcage and jewelry she had been wearing, they were able to identify her as Reagan Toks. He told the court that the DNA on the cigarette butts led investigators to Brian Goolsbee, who was under supervision with the Ohio Adult Parole Authority at the time of her murder. His ankle monitor tracked him each and every step of that, quote, night of terror for Reagan Toks, O'Brien said. He told the jury that they will hear how the GPS tracker plotted his movements that night, giving them a complete timeline of what happened. He said after Brian kidnapped Reagan and forced her into her car, he made her drive to two different ATMs in an attempt to withdraw money, but they were only able to withdraw $60. He said Brian lied in his interrogation with detectives, only mentioning TJ when asked if there was anyone else with him that night. He said they had DNA tying Brian to the crime, gunshot residue evidence, and the fact that Brian told them where the gun was, which they probably wouldn't have found had he not told them. O'Brien told the jury that they will prove each and every one of those counts and specifications beyond a reasonable doubt. In the defense's opening, attorney Court Gatterdam cautioned the jury that what the prosecutor just told them is their story, what they think the evidence will be. But, he said, it's about what the evidence actually is. He said that unless they present proof beyond a reasonable doubt, their verdict must be not guilty. He told them that the defense doesn't have to contest certain evidence, and that if they don't, it doesn't mean that the state has met their burden of proof. He implored them to pay careful attention to the evidence of when the death occurred to when the alleged kidnapping, robbery, and rape occurred. He acknowledged that Brian didn't tell the truth when first talking to detectives, but said that few suspects do. And he pointed out that Brian had agreed to speak with them for 6 hours and to provide them with information about what had happened. As for the GPS evidence, he said it only gives approximate locations, that it doesn't tell you who was doing what at the time. He said Reagan was driving the vehicle throughout the ordeal and that she was the one who pumped gas when they went to a gas station. He said there was no evidence that any suspect was outside the vehicle at that time. And she was driving the car when the car went through the bank drive-thrus, he said. He said that when all the evidence is in, they'll explain what elements within the charges the state did not prove and ask them to acquit. The state called multiple friends of Reagan's to the stand. They described last seeing her, the night of February 8th, and all of them were asked about a purse that she typically carried with her, a black Kate Spade purse. Joshua Durst, a crime scene investigator with the Bureau of Criminal Investigation, or BCI, examined Reagan's car after it had been found on February 10th, 2 days after her disappearance. He said that when he first opened the car door, he noticed an extreme smell of gas. There was also a burn mark on the driver's seat, and when he looked in the trunk, he found an empty red gas can. Inside the car, he found Chase bank receipts, one detailing a $60 withdrawal from a Chase ATM from the night Reagan went missing, and another detailing an attempt to withdraw $500 that was declined. He collected a cigarette butt from the floor of the car behind the driver's seat and then found another one on the ground outside. He said he swabbed Reagan's car for DNA and noted that the driver's side door handle looked like someone had tried to wipe it down. On cross-examination, Brian's attorney questioned why Durst had only collected one of the cigarette butts and not the other. Durst explained that the one found inside the car looked fresh, while the one outside looked weathered, and he didn't think he would be able to get any DNA off that one. Durst was also questioned about his expertise when talking about the burn mark on the driver's seat. He said that he didn't know when it was created and that he was not an arson expert. The state then called three of Brian's acquaintances to the stand to testify about his behavior the night of Reagan's murder and the day after. Tawana Richards testified that Brian was at her house on 17th Avenue the night of February 8th. She said he came over without a car, but that the next day she came home to find a silver Acura outside her house. She said she was surprised that he had driven because he typically took the bus. She described him as looking a little strange that day and said he had a change in his eyes compared to the other times that she had seen him. She said Brian had been dating her niece and that he was frequently hanging out at her house in the weeks prior to February 8th. Talia Nathan told the court that Brian also came over to her mother's home in North Linden on February 8th. She said he was wearing a puffy white coat, and when he said hi to her, he told her to watch out for his coat because he had a gun inside. Leontay Brown said he went to a store with Brian on February 9th and that Brian picked him up in a silver Acura. He said Brian told him that he had just gotten the car. Brian's ex-girlfriend, Hatisa Jackson, testified that in the early morning hours of February 9th, just hours after Reagan's murder, Brian came to visit her, driving a silver Acura. She said it smelled like gasoline and that he told her that he had a gas can in the trunk. She said Brian brought her presents that day, a black Cade Spade purse and $60. Inside the purse was a wallet, lotion, and pepper spray. They went to McDonald's and she said she shared a cigarette with him in the car. A week later, after Brian had been arrested, Hatisa said she was contacted by police and surrendered the purse, which turned out to be Reagan's. We'll get into more testimony right after this quick break from our sponsors. Let's be real. Finding the time to get a lab test is almost impossible, not to mention figuring out how much it will cost you or what your results mean. But now, it's easy to order the tests you want at everlywell.com. Everlywell is an at-home health testing company that offers a variety of tests, from food sensitivity, which measures your sensitivity to 96 different foods that may be causing discomfort, to metabolism, to an at-home STD test. Yep, you can test for STDs all from home. Each test is physician-reviewed, private, simple, and processed through a certified lab. All you have to do is head on over to everlywell.com, choose your tests, and they'll be shipped directly to your doorstep. Once you collect your sample and send it back to Everlywell's certified lab partner, you'll get your doctor-reviewed, easy-to-read results online in days. Everlywell is very convenient. No more sitting in waiting rooms, no more mystery bill, and no more waiting on your results. Head over to everlywell.com and use promo code JUNKIE to take 15% off your first order. That's everlywell.com, promo code JUNKIE for 15% off your first order. Take control of your health today with Everlywell's at-home health tests. Your tests, on your time, and on your terms. Driven by the mission to provide a better place to sleep for everybody, Lisa is an innovative direct-to-consumer online mattress brand that is also socially conscious. In fact, for every 10 mattresses Lisa sells, they donate one to a shelter through their 110 program. They also plant one tree for every mattress sold and donate 1% of each employee's time to volunteer for local causes. How cool is that? Not to mention, with a patented universal adaptive feel, Lisa is designed for all types of sleepers and features three premium foam layers, including 2-inch Avena foam top layer for cooling and breathability, 2-inch memory foam middle layer for body contouring and pressure relief, and 6-inch dense core support foam for durability and structure, which works for sleepers of all sizes. And now Lisa is continuing to expand its offerings to include the Lisa pillow, blanket, foundation, and frame. No wonder it's a Forbes top 20 startup to watch. Try a Lisa mattress in your own home for 100 nights risk-free. Available in the US, UK, Canada, and Germany online with free shipping, this 100% American-made mattress ships compressed in a box right to your door. Or try it at the Lisa Dream Gallery in Soho, New York City, and Virginia Beach, and over 80 West Elm stores nationwide. Get $125 off and a free pillow. It's a great deal. When you go to leesa.com/junkie, that's leesa.com/junkie. Roger Wicks, a senior parole officer, told the court that Brian had in fact been wearing an ankle monitor as a condition of his prior release. He said that parole officers typically have about 90 to 100 offenders to supervise at once, and that the ankle monitors weren't monitored in real time. Instead, it collects GPS data that could be used to determine if the offender was complying with the conditions placed on him. Meaning that instead of monitoring where an offender is at all times, they're only able to check it retroactively. On cross-examination, Wicks told the court that by mid-January 2017, just 2 months after his release, Brian had been sanctioned 3 times. The first time, he failed to keep the ankle monitor charged, and the other 2 times, he had spent the night somewhere other than where he was supposed to be. After 3 violations, he was due to appear before the parole board officer, which could have resulted in going back to prison. But he was arrested for Reagan's murder before he was scheduled for that meeting. Brian's attorney, Diane Menash, then brought up the fact that no one had accessed Brian's GPS data to check up on him until after that 3rd violation. The lead investigator in the case, Richard Forney, from the Grove City Police Department, went over the surveillance video from the night Reagan disappeared and was killed. He first showed the jury surveillance photos of Reagan leaving Bodega at 9:43 p.m. on February 8th. He then showed images of Brian at a Speedway gas station nearly 3 hours later, purchasing a gas can. On February 11th, police arrested Brian and interrogated him for 6 hours. Detective Forney told the jury that Brian seemed to be bargaining with them, trading information for cigarettes, and that he kept asking what evidence they had. Portions of that interrogation video were shown to the jury. In the video, Brian admits to certain things while completely denying others. And his story evolved from first saying he had no idea what they were talking about to then admitting to robbing Reagan and dropping her off at the park where he said he never saw her again, to then saying he robbed her but wasn't the one who raped and killed her, but that he knew who did, a mysterious man named TJ. Brian told the detectives that he did force his way into Reagan's car without her permission after she left work on the night of February 8th. He said he made her drive to 2 Chase Bank locations to withdraw cash. They then drove to a gas station in Turkey Hill and then drove to Scioto Grove Metro Park. He said he told her to take off her clothes. Quote, "I told her to take her clothes off and I told her to go over there and I said, if you move, I'll come back." But he repeatedly denied killing anybody and maintained that he didn't know anything about a gun. "I had her get naked, but I didn't shoot nobody," he said. He said Reagan told him that she just wanted to live and that he told her to stay at the park for 30 minutes and that if she did what he said, then everything would be fine. But the detectives were obviously not buying that Brian had just left her there and didn't kill her. They asked him how, if he wasn't the one who shot her. How did she end up dead? "I couldn't tell you a thing about that," Brian said. But he did admit to buying a gas can from Speedway, saying he was going to try and light Reagan's car on fire. When asked if police would find gunshot residue on the shirt he was wearing at the Speedway gas station, Brian said no. When asked if they would find his DNA on any part of Reagan's body, he said no, denying that he had ever had any sexual contact with her. But after hours of interrogation, his story changed again. This time, after the detectives asked if anyone else was with him, he said yes, a man named TJ. He said TJ had Brian drop him off at the Scioto Grove Metro Park, while Brian and Reagan went to Turkey Hill to get gas. They then returned to the park. He said TJ threatened him, knew the name of his baby mama, Jennifer, and was armed with three guns. He told them TJ wanted money and kept forcing him to give him $1,000, then $2,000. He admitted that he had, in fact, raped Reagan, but said that it was because TJ had forced him to. While sobbing, he recounted how TJ made him get into the driver's side of the vehicle, while TJ then walked around with Reagan and then shot her twice in the head. "Pow," he said, demonstrating how TJ did it. He said he then dropped TJ off at the Continent apartment complex after leaving Reagan at the park. He admitted to trying to burn her car and to getting rid of the evidence, including the gun. He then told them where they could find the gun and the shell casings from the shooting, which were in two separate sewers in a residential area in North London. Detective Forney testified that the GPS data from the ankle monitor didn't support many elements of Brian's story. He then went over Brian's known whereabouts the night of February 8th, according to his GPS ankle monitor. At around 7:30 p.m., Brian takes a bus to downtown Columbus. A surveillance photo was shown to the jury, showing him wearing a large white puffy coat. Around 8:09 p.m., the GPS, which also tracks the speed of his movement, detects that he is walking around the area near Bodega, where Reagan works. At 9:45 p.m., Brian is still in that area, and his speed increases to 20 miles per hour, which shows that he is inside the vehicle at that time. He is then tracked to a Chase bank at 10:04 p.m., where Reagan tries to withdraw $500, but is declined. At 10:14 p.m., Brian is tracked to a Huntington bank, where Reagan is photographed through the bank's surveillance system. She can be seen at the drive-thru, a shadowy figure behind her. At 10:18 p.m., Brian's GPS tracks to an alley for about 12 minutes. This is where prosecutors allege the rape occurred. At 10:32 p.m., Brian is tracked to a Chase bank again. This time, Reagan is able to withdraw $60. She then tries withdrawing an additional $200, but it declines. Brian then goes to two different gas stations at 11:12 p.m. and at 11:41 p.m. 9 minutes later, he tracks to Scioto Grove Metro Park and is there for about 4 minutes. At 12:18 a.m., Brian's GPS is at a speedway. Video surveillance from the station shows him purchasing a gas can. Shortly after this, his GPS slowly makes its way around the neighborhood. This is where Reagan's cell phone is eventually found. He is then tracked to near where the gun and casings were later found, which was also close to his apartment. At about 2:40 a.m., the GPS tracks him to his ex-girlfriend, Hatisa Jackson's apartment, where, as she testified, he gives her the purse and the $60. The two then go to McDonald's. The next morning, the GPS tracks him to the 700 block of Oakwood Avenue, where Reagan's car was found. His apartment is within walking distance, and he is then tracked to his apartment. He later goes to work, goes to his friend Tijuana's, and then takes Valentine's Day presents over to Jennifer and to his daughter. After detailing the timeline according to Brian's GPS, Detective Forney told the jury that there was no evidence to support anyone else's involvement aside from Brian's in Reagan's murder. The state then presented more evidence that tied Brian to the murder. A firearm examination expert with the BCI testified about the gun and shell casings that Brian had led investigators to. He said the shell casings were in fact fired from the revolver, and that the bullets from Reagan's body matched the gun. And a gunshot residue expert testified that gunshot residue was found on the shirt Brian was seen wearing in the surveillance video from the speedway. A forensic biologist with the BCI told the court that a rape kit performed on Reagan resulted in both semen and sperm being present. And another BCI agent testified that the DNA was consistent with Brian Goolsbee. There was also testimony from an agent with the BCI who said that Reagan had walked to the spot where she was found at the park due to the dirt found at the bottom of her feet. And then the state called two women to the stand who had visited Brian in jail and who said that he had actually confessed to them. Jennifer Nickel, Brian's ex and mother of his six-year-old daughter, said Brian would frequently deny having killed Reagan, saying that his friend TJ had done it, until one day in May 2017. She said she went to visit him as she had in the past, but this time she told him that she needed an honest answer. She asked him, "Did you rape Reagan?" And he nodded. She said she started crying and asked if he had killed her, and he nodded again. She said she dropped the phone and left. 2 months later, in July, she said she went back to see him and to ask him why he had done it. She said she needed to know why because they have a daughter together and that this could happen to her. When she asked him why, he said because he wanted money. She said she told him that he had a job and had money, that she didn't understand. But that was the last time she talked to him. Brittany Stepp, a friend of both Jennifer's and Brian's, testified that she also visited Brian in jail. She became emotional on the stand, saying how her three children thought of Brian as an uncle. She described visiting him, also in July, saying to him, "Please don't tell me that you really did this." But she said Brian then admitted it. He said he kidnapped her, robbed her, raped her, and then shot and killed her. When she asked why, he said, I'm sorry, I got scared." Both Jennifer and Brittany said they too saw Brian driving the silver Acura on February 10th, and that Brian had told them that he had bought the car from a guy named TJ, someone neither one of them had ever heard of before. The state's last witness was Deputy Coroner Donald Pohman, who performed the autopsy on Reagan. He identified the cause of death as gunshot wounds to the head and the manner of death as homicide. Autopsy photos were shown to the jury, and Pohman said that two bullets were recovered from Reagan's head. One of the wounds, he said, appeared to have been fired at close range. Both wounds were fatal. After the state rested, the defense announced that they would not be calling any witnesses, including Brian, who was choosing not to testify. And then they, too, rested. In her closing arguments, Jennifer Rausch, the assistant county prosecutor, said Reagan Toks went through every woman's nightmare. She was kidnapped, she was raped, and she was murdered. She went through the evidence they presented and said that the GPS evidence was reliable, that it's 95% accurate within 30 feet. "All I want to do is live," she repeated the phrase that Brian had told the detectives Reagan had said to him. She said Reagan complied with everything he wanted because she had just wanted to live. She also addressed Brian's claims about the mysterious man known as TJ.
"So afterwards, we hear about this TJ guy, right? TJ. Ask yourself if those statements about TJ make any sense at all. Just because we ask you to rely on part of his statement doesn't mean we think he's telling you the whole truth. Okay? So he'll give some admissions all throughout, but never will admit that he's the one that pulled the trigger. At one point, he says TJ has three guns, right? He gives me one and he has two. I don't even know how you have that many hands to have that many guns. That doesn't make any sense at all. He has to pay TJ a bunch of money, right? Like $2,000 or $3,000. But he gets to keep the car. He keeps the $60 from the ATM. He has money to buy the gas can, which we know isn't the $60. Or maybe it is, but he still gives Batista $60. He's got cash to buy the gas can. He's got money to buy them food at McDonald's. He's got money to buy Valentine's Day gifts. But he's got to give all this money to TJ. Does that make any sense? It doesn't make any sense at all. Also, he's talking about how he's so scared. TJ's going to kill him. He's going to kill his family. So what does TJ do, this big bad TJ that's going to kill him? He gives him a gun and sends him away with it. Does that make any sense? He arms him during this offense when he has the three guns. And then at the end of it, he gives him a gun, the gun that he said he threw in the sewer? Does that make any sense? Why wouldn't he just turn the gun on TJ? It doesn't make any sense because it's not true. And then he's so concerned. He talks about how he knew the name of my baby mama, Jennifer. That's his language, his words that he used. He knew my baby mama. There were people there. He said something about having people there. I was worried about her safety. So what's the first thing he does when he gets away from TJ? He goes right to his baby mama to check on her, right? No. After he ditches the evidence, he picks up Patisa, gives her this purse, and then heads on up to McDonald's. Does that make any sense if TJ's real? Absolutely not. TJ does not exist. The defendant is TJ.
She pointed out that Brian's GPS doesn't go to the park where he said he dropped TJ off at while he and Reagan went to get gas. His GPS also doesn't go to the apartments where he claimed he dropped TJ off afterwards. There was also no unidentified DNA anywhere because Brian was the sole perpetrator, she said.
Just because we had a trial does not mean this is a complicated case. And we appreciate you listening to all of it. Okay? You have evidence upon evidence upon evidence of each and every one of these counts and all of the specifications. He kidnapped her. He robbed her. He raped her. And then he executed her in that field. We're asking you to use your reason and your common sense. Those are your most important tools as jurors. And we are confident that when you do that and you do what you promised you would do in voir dire, that there is only one verdict that you can return on this case, and that's guilty of everything.
In their closing arguments, Brian's attorney, Diane Menashe, reminded jurors, by using their individual names, that they had said during jury selection that they could be fair and impartial. She said the feelings you get when you hear the graphic words and see the graphic pictures in the case have to be put aside. She said the state is alleging that the murder in count one was done with prior calculation and design. And this is the count that could give Brian the death penalty.
The state would have you believe that this guy is capable of prior calculation and design. And with all due respect to Mr. Goldsby, if Mr. Goldsby were that smart, he wouldn't have been wearing a GPS monitor while he's committing crimes.
She said he didn't invoke his right to counsel and that he spoke to police for 6 hours. She said he put gas on one seat and a cigarette on the other and then drove the car around while police were looking for it and while the car was on the news. This is not an individual that's capable of planning and developing a scheme. She said she would suggest the opposite, that it's his inability to plan that put him here. She said the state wants to have their cake and eat it too. One of their detectives testified that the question of, was there anyone else with you, during the interrogation is a technique that they often use to get people to admit to at least some elements of the crime while blaming other elements on someone else. She said a lot of people fall for it and that Brian did too. She then conceded that there was no TJ.
Mr. Goddardam and I have been in front of you for weeks now. And certainly, although what you think of us is not evidence, we have done nothing to present to you a theory of TJ because Brian is TJ. And what that means is the interviewing technique worked. But yet they want to blame him for TJ and for making it up and saying he's such a master manipulator. Members of the jury, if you want to believe that he's a master manipulator, then I would submit this to you. He would have bargained for a whole lot more than a cigarette for giving the state of Ohio a murder weapon. Because if you think he's a good negotiator, I would suggest to you that that's not very good negotiation. Because he got a cigarette, he gave him the gun, the casings, the phone, and a confession. So again, when Ms. Roush talks to you about TJ and trying to sell you on the fact that he's a master manipulator, and certainly Mr. Loeb will get up here in his rebuttal and talk more about TJ, let's just take TJ out of it. TJ's Brian. But you know what? Brian never says TJ did, and you will have the tape back there. Brian never says TJ planned to kill her. Never said TJ had a scheme. Never said that night he set out to kill someone. Never said that he waited by a bodega until one of the people came out and then he stalked her. Because you have the GPS. He's just wandering. He's just wandering. So if you know or you believe TJ is Brian, then what did he say TJ did? Because there is no evidence in his statement about prior calculation and design. None.
And if it sounds like she's admitting that Brian killed Reagan, she is. As it turns out, the defense wasn't arguing that Brian was innocent, only that he should be found guilty of murder, not aggravated murder. In other words, they were trying to save his life.
Now, the state of Ohio stood up here and they said in their first closing that it's the second shot that is prior calculation design. Members of the jury, I ask you to go back to that jury instruction on page 5. Read it again and again, please. I so much ask you to. The second shot is purpose. There is no doubt that the second shot is purpose. And you now will have, as to count one, a lesser included of murder to consider. And murder is a purposeful killing. And you now have murder to consider for count one. That's what that second shot is. Can't get around that. Two shots is purpose. Can't say it's accidental. We agree.
She told the jury that when Brian told his friend Brittany when she visited him in jail that he was sorry, that he got scared. That I got scared is not prior calculation and design. She told the jury to take their time and look carefully over every verdict form. About an hour into their deliberations, one juror had to be removed after a, quote, concerned citizen called to say that he or she had been discussing the case outside of the jury room. That juror was removed and deliberations continued. And after 6 hours of deliberating, they found Brian guilty of all counts. Since Brian was found guilty of aggravated murder, that meant the death penalty was on the table. The trial phase was over, but now the penalty phase was about to begin, where the jury would weigh both aggravating and mitigating factors in the case. Prosecutor O'Neill told the jury that the prosecution does have the burden of proof in this phase, but that they believe that the aggravating factors of the murder outweigh the mitigating factors and that Brian deserved the death sentence. But Brian's attorney, Diane Menasche, disagreed and started out by telling the jury about Brian's story. She said Brian was born to a single mother, Stephanie Goolsbee, who abused him and who was eventually diagnosed with personality disorders with sadistic tendencies. He was taken out of the home several times as a child and placed in and out of foster care. When he was 12, she said he was anally raped by a neighbor in a local store. He ran home and told his mother, but she didn't call police. As a teenager, she said Brian was diagnosed with a mental illness and was given medication for it, but his mother took it from him. She said Brian sexually acted out, but that he only did so after having been raped at the age of 12, and that after being sent away to boot camp, he received sexual offender treatment. In his later teenage years, Brian went from one group home to another and started to commit misdemeanor crimes. Then at 18, he committed his first felonies, receiving stolen property. He was sent to a youth jail and stayed there for 3 years until his 21st birthday. While he was there, she said he was exposed to gang violence and that he came out a worse person than when he went in. She recounted how at the age of 23, he pleaded guilty to robbery and attempted rape and was sentenced to 6 years. Then at 29, he was released from prison and just months later was arrested for Reagan's murder. She said the system failed Brian and the system failed Reagan. They failed to properly monitor. They failed to drug test. They failed to revoke his supervision. Because they failed, she said, that's a systemic failure.
At no point ever, today, tomorrow, or Tuesday, when I make my closing argument, will I ever ask any of you to feel sorry for Brian. I don't expect you to think he's a nice guy. I'm not going to even try and sell that to you. I'm asking you to use your empathy to try and think about what it would be like to live a life that's that chaotic and unstable. Certainly I'm asking that. But here's what I'm not asking you to do. I'm not asking you to take the mitigation and the information that we present to you as an excuse as to why Brian did what he did on February 8th and 9th. I'm not, because there is no excuse for it. Mr. Goddardam and I tried this case in the first phase, I think with class and dignity. I stood up here in closing argument and I conceded that TJ is Brian. We picked our battles with witnesses, and I hope you use that credibility, that street cred that we built up, and apply it here. Because I'm not offering you this information as an excuse, I'm offering it to you as an understanding of why that man sits at that table, why he acts like he does, why he is the man he is. I'm not asking you to like him. I'm not asking you to feel sorry for him or pity him. But I am asking you to use your empathy to try and feel what it would be like to live through what he has lived through.
She asked them not to kill Brian. Brian himself also spoke to the jury during the sentencing phase. He said, quote, "Today, I would like to apologize to the Tokes family for the conduct committed against their daughter, friends, and family." He admitted that when he first got locked up, he lied about everything, and that there was no TJ, that he wasn't real. Quote, "I made up TJ because I was trying to wiggle my way out of the crime that I had committed. The only other thing I have to say is, please have mercy on me." Reagan's mother, Lisa McCrary Tokes, also spoke to the jury.
Regardless of the outcome of today's verdict, it doesn't bring our daughter back. It doesn't erase the night of terror that Reagan had to endure. It doesn't erase the graphic details and images that are forever burned into our minds. Most importantly, it doesn't change that she wasn't granted her last wish. And to quote our daughter, her last words, "I just want to live." These words from the mouth of a kind, vibrant, loving soul that had her whole life ahead of her still. The terror and pain that she endured that night at the hands of evil, she deserved better. And our loss and pain will never get better. What can never be taken from us, however, is the love that we had and have as a family, and the love and memories that we shared with Reagan. We will remain vigilant and hold steadfast to that love and to our faith. We know that Reagan is in heaven and evil has not won. We will continue to honor her memory and legacy in a positive, loving way. We will take the high road and focus our energy on doing good, just like Reagan was. Her beautiful, bright, vibrant light and energy, love and spirit is forever.
Now, the jury had a few options. They could unanimously decide to sentence Brian to death, or they would have to decide between life in prison with the option of parole after 25 years, life in prison with the option of parole after 30 years, or life in prison with no option for parole at all. They deliberated for over 7 hours, and in the end, they decided on life in prison without the possibility of parole. A month later, Brian pleaded guilty to 6 counts of aggravated robbery for that string of robberies he committed prior to Reagan's death. The judge in that case added an additional 66 years to Brian's life sentence, after remarking that the adult parole authority bared some responsibility for not properly monitoring Brian. On April 11th, 2018, one of the bills in the Reagan-Tokes Act unanimously passed out of the Ohio Senate. This bill, Senate Bill 201, would change how violent felons are sentenced and how they are released. The other bill, involving reforming the GPS monitoring system, is still being worked on. And meanwhile, the Tokes family has also started a foundation, the Reagan Delaney Tokes Memorial Foundation, which will annually award a scholarship to Ohio State University in Reagan's name. And that's all for today's episode. Let me know what you think about this case. Do you think that the GPS monitoring system for offenders needs to be reformed? And what else do you think could have been done to prevent this, given Brian's violent past? You can join my discussion group on Facebook at courtjunkie.com/Facebook, or you can let me know on Twitter at CourtJunkiePod or you can email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. As a reminder, if you want to hear these Court Junkie episodes early and ad-free, all you have to do is go to courtjunkie.com/support, which will send you over to my Patreon page. There, you can sign up and donate as little as a dollar a month. You'll then get access to an exclusive feed that you can add to any podcast listening app. And on that feed will be early ad-free episodes of courtjunkie.com. I want to thank all of today's sponsors and give a special thank you to Everly Well. Finding the time to get a lab test is almost impossible, but now it's easy to order the tests you want at everlywell.com. Everly Well is an at-home health testing company that offers a variety of physician-reviewed private tests, from food sensitivity to metabolism to thyroid. No more sitting in waiting rooms or waiting on your results. Head on over to everlywell.com and use promo code JUNKIE to take 15% off your first order. Everly Well, your test on your time and on your terms. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.